Blog Talk Radio.
Let's not stand on ceremony, mate. Let's start the show.
We would be honored.
I did not do that, Sydney. I would never hit you. I love you. I would never do that, James. It was him. He's here. I
enough,
swear to you.
Enough. See, enough. Just stop it.
Are you okay?
I don't want to say Sydney. I'm sorry. I would never.
Hey. See? Right now, my priority is getting my baby somewhere safe. Do you understand?
Welcome, everybody, to Cinema Royale. I'm Travis Hobson of FunStrongCritics.com. And on the line with me is my boy, John Nolan, also at FunStrongCritics.com. What's up, man?
What's up? How's it going?
It's going, man. That clip you're just listening to was from The Invisible Man, which was the number one movie at the box office this week. This was like born from the ashes of Universal's Dark Universe. Remember how they tried to do that shit a couple years ago, start the Dark Universe? Which is like
this
these
time
movies.
They're doing it right.
Well, this time they're doing it right. And in my review, I actually put in there, I was like, what if they had started the Dark Universe with this rather than with, well, they started with Dracula Untold, and then when that movie underperformed, they retconned it out and said that The Mummy with Tom Cruise was the actual start. And then when that bombed, they're like, okay, forget it.
Yeah, we're done with this universe.
I dare say they lost a lot more money on The Mummy than they did on Dracula Untold, which I think like me and
oh,
the
yeah.
early book even. But it didn't cost as much as The Mummy did, and it certainly wasn't as visible of a flop as The Mummy.
And honestly, Dracula Untold wasn't that bad. I mean, it wasn't as bad as The Mummy in the sense that The Mummy tried to not take any steps into new territory and just threw a high-dollar actor in it, whereas Dracula Untold actually expanded the lore a little bit.
Yeah, I thought Dracula Untold was actually okay.
Yeah.
And I thought The Mummy was watchable, but like barely watchable. It was a fine film, and if it wasn't attached to all this other crap, it probably would have flown by and nobody would have cared. But
it
had all this, you know, expectations heaped on it, all this money heaped on it, and it was just like, oh, no. I mean, I much prefer the Brendan Fraser movies, which are some of my favorite movies ever.
That's where they should have started the cinematic universe, or at least brought him back. Well, maybe not nowadays, but I mean, the Mummy, the Tom Cruise one, it wasn't a horrible movie, you're absolutely right, but it was completely forgettable, and it wasn't something that made you have any more interest in that world. I mean, even if when you bring in, you know, the introduction of Russell Crowe as Dr. Jekyll, you know, even that kind of like just blew by. It's like, oh yeah, I don't care, you know.
Yeah, no, I didn't crap about it. So we're gonna be talking a little bit more about The Invisible Man. We're gonna talk a little bit about the film Emma with Anya Taylor-Joy, who is been moving up the ranks for me. I'm starting to really kind of dig her a little bit. We're talking about Steven Spielberg leaving Indiana Jones 5. We're going to get your thoughts on that. And James Mangold, looks like he might be coming in to replace him. There was the old She-Hulk thing with Alison Brie, that was that took up a couple of days worth of rumors this week. Talk a little bit about that. The Guns Akimbo controversy. I don't know if you've been paying attention to this.
I haven't. What's that all about?
Well, without getting too much into it, I want to talk about it later, but the Guns Akimbo controversy. Guns Akimbo is the film with Daniel Radcliffe where he plays the guy who has the guns bolted to his hands.
Right.
Really ridiculous premise. Movie that you know, a lot of people really expected to see. But the director, Jason Lee Howden, got into a bit of controversy this past week. He basically bullied a couple of black female critics on social media over some past stuff with another writer who said something racist online, and she got, as you'd expect, killed on social media for doing it. And she, one of her friends said that she just contemplated suicide. So what the director of Guns Akimbo did, he blamed these two female critics for bullying this girl, which they didn't. There's no evidence to show they did anything, actually. They weren't involved. But he bullied them, sicked his fans on them, continues to do so, actually. And there was some talk of what a lot of people decided to not run their reviews of Guns Akimbo based on his actions. And there was some debate about whether or not the studio was going to actually pull the movie because of what he did. I had been tweeting about it, actually, about whether or not I was going to post my review. Ultimately, I did decide to run my review. I'm not going to know why. But yeah, so this is the whole thing. Now you can just talk about it, so there you go. But that was the thing that was going on with Guns Akimbo. And basically, and I'll just, you know, since we're talking about it now, I'll just go ahead and say, I posted my review because... despite what Jason Lee Howe did, and I think he did pretty despicable, I don't blame everybody else involved in the movie. I don't blame Daniel Radcliffe. I don't blame Samara Weaving. I don't blame the crew. I don't blame the producers. This is something that he did long after the movie was done, you know, and long after their part in it was done. And they had
nothing
to do. Now, if he continues to be an asshole, which it looks like he is and these people go and decide to make another movie with him, I would be less inclined to run a review of his movie, as long as he's doing it. And I will probably not run a review of his movie, or until he does something to make up for what he's doing right now. So,
right.
But I didn't feel it appropriate to hold everybody else accountable for what one person did.
Yeah, and that happens a lot where, you know, something, you know, a guy doing stuff like that obviously deserves to get some payback or get some comeuppance. But, you know, it's easy when we go down to something that an actor or a director or somebody did, that there's thousands of people involved in these productions. And there's plenty of people that, you know, once something tanks or once something doesn't do well, many more people are affected. You know, it doesn't make what he's doing right at all, but, you know, there is more to it than just that one person. And I think a lot of people want to get hurt for what one dickhead does.
Right, exactly. So my review of Guts Kimbo is up on Shuffle.com. Go check it out. I also want to talk about the runtime for No Time to Die. Did you see that? The runtime?
Yeah, I did.
Okay, let's talk about that.
And I'm totally okay with it because it should be as long as possible
good.
To herald that, the
okay.
Daniel Craig era.
All right. Well, that's good. I'm glad you feel that way. We'll talk about that a little later on. But anyway, thanks for tuning in to Cinema Royale. Like I said, you can find us every day at punchdownbooks.com. A lot of big changes coming up at the site over the next day or two. So stick with us through that. So let's talk to the Invisible Man. We talked about it a little bit already. How this was kind of from the remnants of the Dark Universe. And they handed the reins of the movie over to Blumhouse, who just 2 weeks ago kind of crapped the bed with Fantasy Island. And now they're back again already. It's like two movies in the span of like 2 weeks from them.
But that's Blumhouse.
That's Blumhouse. And this one only cost $7 million. So, hey, you know, that's what you have. But this version is updated, contemporary take. It stars Elizabeth Moss as a woman who escaped from her abusive boyfriend, Adrian, who was a scientist in the field of optics. And she gets away from him. He's an abusive boyfriend. And soon after, he commits suicide. Only she soon after begins being harassed and attacked by an unseen figure. Of course, nobody believes her because I went into this not knowing what to expect. I knew I was going to like Elizabeth Moss because she's great, and nobody does Unravel better than she does. I don't think anybody does. She's fantastic at that. But this movie started off with this amazing escape sequence. It's a slow burn escape sequence for her. She's trying to escape from the house, and the director is Lee Whannell, who you probably know from Saw films and Insidious Chapter 3 and the little scene but wildly underrated Upgrade, which is fantastic. He does really great things with light and sound in that opening sequence. It felt like I was watching A Quiet Place again. And it was amazing. And they got the movie off to this fantastic start. And, well, it goes a little tiny bit off the rails at certain points, you know. I think it maintains that feel, that tension all the way throughout the movie. And I really, really dug this a lot. What did you think of this movie?
I mean, before I even get into Lee Whannell and what was done as far as filmmaking to its merits, you got to really take it back. I mean, like you mentioned, these are the Universal monsters, which haven't had their day in the sun for a very, very long time. These are the originals, the OGs. And the least scary one of them all, at least in my mind at this point, was the Invisible Man. I mean, I don't know anybody that thinks of the Invisible Man prior to this as anything more than a pervert. Like, it's terrifying to think that you can't see somebody there. But, I mean, seriously, when you think of the Invisible Man, what do you think of? Like, him sitting in locker rooms and shit, right? And I think that's what most people got. He was like a prankster, mischievous pervert kind of guy. Well, the smartest thing any horror director can do, if you want to come up with something scary, is you take something that is already commonplace or something that we're not currently scared of and put a twist to make it scary. And as unfortunate as it is to say, domestic abuse and things like this are commonplace, and they're scary enough as they are. But when you take that abusive boyfriend or abusive girlfriend or stalker or whatever, and you now make them invisible, that's the simplest little twist that brings this story right into modern times, gives it a whole new level of terror, and this is how you update old properties. This is how you take something that was scary in the 50s and you make it scary today. Because as a guy, you know, I know domestic abuse against men is out there, but it's not something that's really talked about. It's not something we really worry about. It's more the exception than the rule. So if this scared me in that level, I can't imagine, you know, how women felt watching. And Lee Whannell has always been amazing. He's always good, and he just excels here as well. So the whole idea behind it.
Solo filmmaker. He's gotten better. So, I think he was great when he used to work with James Wan in Saw films. He wrote a couple of things, but as he's gone off on his own as a solo director, he's gotten better. I can't remember much about Insidious Chapter 3, so I'm front there. But Upgrade is amazing. The Upgrade was the poor man's Venom that was better than Venom. I mean, it was so much fun. And there are aspects of The Invisible Man that was sort of like that. Like, it's sort of B-movie-esque in some of its details. It's kind of off-kilter. I like that stuff about Upgrade and about The Invisible Man. That stuff works for me. He's a great choice for it, and he wrote the script as well, which is even better. He wrote the script for it, which watching it, you almost kind of think that a woman wrote it in some cases. You know, the way it shows the gaslighting, the way women of abuse are disbelieved by the public, by even the people around them. That stuff to me felt very unimportant. And, you know, I have the best perspective, but to me it felt unimportant. And, you know, that stuff worked. And like you said, this is the way if you're going to reinvent the classic movie monsters, let them be monsters. This guy was a monster in this movie. This guy's a monster. And
it doesn't have to look like Freddy Krueger.
Right, they didn't do the cheap thing, just kind of make the Invisible Man like an anti-hero or something stupid like that. They made him the bad guy, and he's the bad guy throughout this movie. I thought that was just a great choice.
Right, and I think that's something that's actually a really important distinction when you're doing these things, and that's the trick with the Universal Monsters. I think one of the reasons they can't really put their shit together to get a universe is that you can't. We might have come a long way as a people, but you still can't really base a franchise or universe on villains. I mean, you can have the Joker, he's a villain. You can have Venom, who's an anti-hero, but they always try to go that anti-hero route. You can't do that and still display some of these people properly because at the end of the day, these are villains. These are monsters. These are the original, you know, ghouls. And you got to go all the way with it. And I think that's one of the things Blumhouse does best, and for the exact reason that you brought up when we first started talking about this last week or 2 weeks ago, rather, Fantasy Island tanks hard. Blumhouse is the only studio around, and I'm including Netflix in them, that will take serious chances because they've discovered this perfect formula that's pretty common sense when you think about it, where they make a bunch of movies really cheaply while still delivering a quality product. So if it fails, it doesn't break the bank. And when they hit, they've made their money for the year. They can make 5 Fantasy Islands for what they made profit-wise off Invisible Man already. And so that responsible business with the creative angle that they put into everything is why Blumhouse is always going to be a leader in horror. And really, other studios should take that as a line to take it in other genres.
Horror movies are the last.
What's that?
Horror movies are the last genre that needs to be expensive. I never really understood it. We went through this
phase.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't see why other genres have to be expensive either. Like comedies and dramas. Action movies I get, but comedies and dramas. I mean, even you could just look at the, and we're getting to something totally different here, but the incredible overspending and lack of frugality in Hollywood. I still remember when District 9 came out for $25,000. It looked better than every other $100,000 movie that came out, $100 million movie that came out that year.
No, I mean, no, you're right. I mean, it's true, and I can't tell you the number of times I've done the box office and a movie that does reasonably well, still ends up a failure because it just costs too much. Like a prime example
right.
would be this, be The Call of the Wild, which, you know, overall after 2 weeks has $79 million worldwide. Well, I mean, that would probably be fine for a movie like Call of the Wild. But it cost $125 million, which Call of the Wild should not cost $125 million. I mean,
it makes no sense.
It shouldn't cost it. It shouldn't cost that much. But they did
it's Harrison
the whole,
Ford and a dog.
Right. Well, they did the whole thing in CGI from, you know, and so it cost a ton. And I say, well, that's what you get. I mean, that's why it cost you money. You should have just done it. You should have just went to a location and shot the stupid thing outdoors. You know,
because it's not cheaper. It's easier, but it's not cheaper.
Right.
I mean, George Romero, when I was talking to George Romero one time, look at me name dropping, he explained CGI in a very, I always thought it was because it was cheaper. Or it looked better, but he told me straight up because the movie I was talking about was the first time he used CG, and I said, so what's with the change to CG? Is it more cost effective? He goes like, no, it actually costs more. It's just easier. You know, if you have a scene where you blow a guy's head off, and you mess up that scene, you have to reset, and it takes 3 hours and la di da di. And but if you have CG, you just fake it, and then you can put it on screen. So it's not so much that it's cheaper, or looks better even. It's just that it's easier, and you can get more done in the time. So. It's like anything else in life, you know, you can do things fast, good, or cheap. You can't do all three. I mean, you can do two maybe, not all three.
So I think we both endorsed The Invisible Man as we need to check out. Like I said, it did $49 million worldwide. Box office was really good. for.
I
believe it's R-rated. I'm pretty sure it's R-rated. Thriller aimed at adults. Really, the only big name in it is Elizabeth Moss.
Who's really like an undercover big name these days, especially in this. You don't get this in horror movies a lot, where you're going to bring in a huge female audience, and she's got a even bigger staple on that because of The Handmaid's Tale. You know, she's a huge name right now in women's entertainment. I guess you would say, is that sexist to say? I don't know.
Probably. Sonic the Hedgehog is number 2. $128 million just right now. I think it's got more than double that. All the while, it's just talking about that. My Hero Academia did really well, see $9 million. I never watched the second of that show. That's why Khalil did the review.
right.
Life, Harley Quinn. Impractical Jokers is up to $5.9 million. It's actually done really well.
Are you a fan of that show?
No, not at all. But I always see the commercials. And those guys are so goddamn annoying. I don't ever want to watch them.
And it really is. But they have a surprisingly big audience.
They have a huge audience. The show's been on for almost a decade.
I mean,
a long time. And I know people, I've hung out with people who, whenever I go over their house, they're watching Impractical Jokers. They just have it on True TV. And Impractical Jokers is always on. And so, I mean, they have a huge audience. As evidenced by the numbers that he's doing, almost $6 million for a hidden camera type show, type movie. It's not, unless you're Jackass.
It's insane.
It's not very often. I was really disappointed by Wendy. Wendy didn't do anything. Wendy is the Philippines. I love the guy who introduced the show about 8 years ago. But it only opened in like a few theaters, and it made $30,000. The per site average was like $7,000, which is really terrible. Really not good at all. And Pixar probably hasn't get on their hands on the urgent state. They did a sneak preview of that joint over the weekend in 470 theaters at one showing, in 470 theaters in 650K. So, so they probably got to meet on their, which is interesting. They don't do this sort of thing often when they do sneak previews, but they do them for the movies that are sort of flying under the radar. And Onward is one of those movies that's kind of been, the buzz for it hasn't been as strong. The reviews have been good, including mine. My review of this is really good. But there hasn't been as much buzz, but not like the kind they get like Finding Nemo or something like that. But
right.
Apparently, based on these numbers, people were really looking forward to it. So, do you want to talk Emma? You saw Emma, right?
We can for a little bit. I mean, my review is mostly going to be about Anya Taylor-Joy, or Anna Taylor-Joy, as I always forget to call her by the correct name, and how she has just undercover stolen my heart, I'll tell you.
Wow.
She is a pretty woman. But I've never really been a fan. This is like the fourth time this year that my lack of motivation and 7th and 8th grade language arts has come to smack me in the face with Little Women and a couple other movies, and now another Jane Austen book. Have you read Jane Austen at all?
I've read Emma. But it's just, here's my thing when it comes to these. Jane Austen, now I'm not in the demo, right? And neither are you. But really, really,
right.
I'm not in the demo. Like, I'm seriously not in the demo. Mm-hmm. And when I went to go see this, I was like, I'm not excited for this at all. I already know the story of Emma. I don't want to see this. And my friend was like, pretend it's a remake of The Clueless. Which I was of Clueless. Because Clueless.
Right.
Clueless is a modern reimagining of Emma. Right? So she was like, imagine this is a remake of Clueless. So I was like, I'll have some fun with it. And you know what? The movie is fun. And I found myself actually really digging it. the beats are familiar. If you know the story of Emma, all that stuff is in here. But it has this sort of tongue-in-cheek attitude towards it that I really, really dug. Largely, most of that comes from, like, Bill Nye, whatever his last name is, as Emma's father, who's just a riot throughout this movie. He is hilarious every single time he shows up, worried about cold drafts in the home, those kinds of stuff. He's great. I actually had a lot of fun with this. I didn't think I was going to. These new kind of period pieces, it seems like we've entered a period where they are no longer doing the straight anymore. Like we used to, like, yeah. we used to get like a Pride and Prejudice or even like the Paltrow, I think Paltrow did a Paltrow. Somebody did another one. But they would just give you the straight adaptation. They'd be kind of dry and dull, like, okay. But they're always sort of like a rite of passage for a certain rising star actress, like the period.
Yeah.
Like, everyone gets Reese Witherspoon. Okay, let's put her in Vanity Fair and The Importance of Being Earnest. Like, everybody gets one. And Anya Taylor-Joy is getting hers. But they don't make them like those movies anymore. They make them with a sort of ironic aspect to them now, which I think is making like them. Because I've really enjoyed this as much as I've enjoyed almost anything else in this year. I really had a lot of fun.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, Cortland wrote the review for our site, and I think it was much better handled in her hands than ours because, you know, one of the twists they put on it that I didn't
way
think so much,
but
just...
But one of us dudes right now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, well, it's an important distinction because one of the things she caught is how they handle the relationships and the sexuality and things like that in the movie, and they handle it, you know, they kind of show the woman's side of it more, which... You know, if you're not looking for it, you're a dude, it kind of flies by your head. But, you know, once it's presented to you, you're like, okay, yeah, yeah, this is totally different than the way they used to do it. And I don't think, I think the fact that they are doing these ironic or whatever you want to call it, twists to these classics is the best thing that could happen because there's literally no point in just redoing something that's already been done. Every 50 years, okay, because let's be honest, it's hard to watch movies from that long ago. The acting's weird and the screen looks bad. But, you know, there's no reason to adapt these things that have been adapted 1,000 times if you're doing straight adaptation. So what they're doing now brings us not only the culture to a whole new generation, but makes it appealing and watchable and finds some subtext that we've never really seen in these stories before.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And, yeah, so I'm down for more of Anya Taylor-Joy doing this kind of thing. But... The next time we're going to see her is as Ilyana Rasputin in New Kids. So,
which is it? Just me, or has the public conscience around that seemed to have come around that people are actually looking forward to it again now?
It seems like it's okay. It seems like it's flip flopped a little bit. So, after the first trailer more than 2 years ago, everybody was like, "Oh, this looks like this might be crap." You know. Mainly because they, you know, they pulled the release date. There's all the stuff around the Disney sale, and all that kind of stuff threw it into chaos. Talking reshoots, blah blah blah. And then 2 years later, we get the new trailer, which is much better. And yeah, for a while there, people were like, "Damn, this actually looks like it could be good." And now, as things have died down again, I think the negativity is sort of creeped back. Now, in terms of me personally, I'm looking forward to it. I've always been looking forward to it. But I'm looking forward to more forward to it now, based off that last trailer. I think it actually does be good. However, the projections for it are doing really badly at the box office.
Yeah, I have the biggest...
The projections are really crappy.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a very slim chance, regardless of where the public opinion sways by them, there's a very slim chance it's going to be a smash hit because it just doesn't happen when movies have this kind of production history. But I really have had high hopes for this just because this is going to be one of the first times that we would have seen superhero movies do what I've always wanted them to do, and that is break into different genres and just apply the superhero movie as as a piece of a regular genre movie. You can have a horror or an action or a romance or whatever. And that's kind of already happening. You know, WandaVision, I'm sure, will capture all of those things. But this was going to be a straight horror movie with superheroes or mutants in it. And I just hope it's not totally forgotten, you know, that idea can happen.
If Marvel were smart, they would, I mean, and they've kind of done this a little bit, like, kind of tease that it's part of the MCU and kind of not,
mm-hmm.
like, play it down the middle. Like, oh, I mean, I think what they're doing is if the movie, like, unexpectedly hits and it's, like, makes $100 million in its first couple weeks or something, they might be like, okay, let's stick with this and make it part of the MCU.
Yeah,
and
they're the new Avengers now.
And then if it bombs, which is very likely to happen, if it bombs, they can disavow the thing. Like, well,
right.
that was just us wrapping up the Fox version of the X-Men. And that's it. So I think they're trying to play both ways to see how it's going to play out. I hope it's a hit, because I like the cast that's in it. It would be such a waste to have Anya Taylor-Joy, Maisie Williams, Alice Braga, all these people in the movie who are fantastic and that I'd kill to see in the MCU or anything else, and have them be bombed, and then they basically not want to use them for the MCU for a long time. I don't want that,
right,
man. I don't want that. I hope the movie surprises people and that it does work. That's my hope.
We shall see. I'm with you. I hope the same. For Maisie Williams and Charlie Heaton, you know, both got cast in that movie at the top of their buzz and heat for Stranger Things and Game of Thrones, and now the movie's going to come out with this sordid history after their buzz has all died down from those shows.
Exactly right. All right, let's talk about Indiana Jones 5, which I had commented earlier in the week. Because Harrison Ford was talking about the movie, so they weren't going to do it unless they could guarantee that the movie was going to be great. And at the time, I had said if any other movie had the kind of troubled pre-production that Indiana Jones 5 has had, we would be writing that movie off. Any other movie.
Right.
But the only reason we don't is because it's Indiana Jones, and because Harrison Ford and Steven Spielberg have been attached to it. If it was anything else, we'd be like, this movie's going to be a joke. Forget it. And then the very next day, Spielberg drops out. Drops out. He is out as Indiana Jones 5 director after all this time of being attached to it and being really the only director on this franchise. He's out. And talks are that James Mangold is going to be replacing him. Now, I got no complaints about James. I've loved almost everything he's done. Walk the Line, 310 to Yuma, Logan, The Wolverine, Ford v. Ferrari, which is my top five movies of the year. I mean, I love James Mangold. And he'll probably do a perfectly fine job on the Indiana Jones 5. But I'm going to tell you what I don't like about this happening. I don't like that Indiana Jones is now just another Disney. Like I missed Star Wars. George Lucas, take it or leave him, right? Like, I get it. We all have our things that we hate about him. But that was his thing. And it felt like it was coming from him, because it was. We knew that everything that was involved with it was something that was coming from him. It felt like everything felt personal to him. And so that's gone. That's gone now. And now it's just another brand. With this, Indiana Jones is just going to be good. And that, to me, is very, very sad.
Was there anything they could have done with it other than make it another brand? I mean, Harrison Ford is 80 years old or whatever. And, I mean, it just seems there were a lot of jokes made in the late 80s and early 90s about the stars of that day not letting go, whether it was, Back to the Future saying Jaws 47 or, whatever movie saying Rocky 28. But we're there now, and these guys are still holding on. And as much as I love them, and as much as we all love them, there comes a point where Harrison Ford can be in Star Wars as Han Solo when he's just walking around and flying a ship. That's believable. But as Indiana Jones, unless he's just going to be Professor Jones this time, then I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't see any other way this could have gone.
Yeah, no, but it's not that, though. Like, Harrison Ford's not the issue. Harrison Ford has probably been one of the few stars more willing to give up on that crap from the past than anybody else. Like,
sure.
Nobody talks more crap about the stuff they've done than he does. Just go to it. I've seen enough interviews and been in the room with them when somebody's asked him some dumbass question about one of his past characters and have him diss them to his face, to their face. He does not care.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, I mean, it's not him that's the issue. And, of course, at some point he has to retire from it. But it's just Steven Spielberg, Lucasfilm, Harrison Ford, that was Indiana Jones. That's Indiana Jones. And
right now,
with Spielberg being out, it's no longer that. It's just another movie. It's just another movie. And there's something sad about losing that stuff. Would it eventually have to change? Of course. Of course it does. But to break up the Ford, Spielberg, Lucasfilm triumvirate is just really sad. It's really sad. So,
yeah,
I don't want to see. No matter what, the next Indiana Jones movie won't feel the same.
Yeah, and I mean, I love Indiana Jones. I mean, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is still one of my favorite movies of all time. I'm pretty sure those movies are what gave me my my fascination with, like, the Nazis and their occult stuff and all that. But it seems like it should just be left.
I'm just going to clip that part out and save it.
Yeah, fascination with Nazis, okay. I didn't say my love for them. I said my fascination. Which, by the way, you almost didn't have me on this episode because I have been putting off watching Hunters since it came out, a week or two ago.
Yeah.
I turned it on, and damn, I'm hooked in. Al Pacino is
really
actually right. He's pretty solid. It's pretty solid, man. It's really good. And it's funny. It's like the Quentin Tarantino. It's got like this Tarantino twist on it when they introduce the hunters, and it's, I don't know, you got to see it, I won't take too much time because I'll get on it, but yeah, but I think Indiana Jones should just kind of, I could be wrong, and some new twist could come out, and I could be blown away and be happy it's here, but I just don't see the Indiana Jones universe isn't a universe the way Star Wars is or something like that where it can expand to everyone else, and there's all these other places you can get charismatic characters from. It was always Indy. Everybody else was secondary in those movies.
I don't know. I'm not looking forward to Indiana Jones 5. If I'm honest, I wasn't looking forward to it with Spielberg there. But I'm really not looking forward to it. I have no interest. The Crystal Skull really killed my interest in Indiana Jones. I mean, it really did. I really disliked that movie. And then, you know, it's been more than 20 years. What do I want another one for? Like, I don't. Don't have no interest in it.
That's what I'm saying. There's nowhere else to take it. There really isn't. And I mean, I'm not a writer. I can be extremely wrong about that. But in my estimation, there's nowhere else to take this series. You know, we tried Aliens. You know, anytime they stray from Nazis, you get a second tier plot. I mean, Temple of Doom, which I loved when I was a kid, ends up being, you know, history shows it's a second tier plot and people don't like it as much. I don't know.
Temple of Doom is not that great. In fact, it's not a great movie at all. It's fine. But it's hard to compete with Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Last Crusade. It's really
100%,
hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to compete with those movies. So I don't know. Crystal Skull doesn't even come close.
Right.
So a couple days worth of rumors this week. Had Alison Brie up for the role of She-Hulk in Marvel's Disney Plus series. The first day was basically, you know, some site said that Marvel's looking for Alison Brie type, which I guess means that they want Alison Brie. Because if you're looking for that type of person, you really want that person, but you don't think you can get them.
You don't think you can get them, but
that's what that means. Right.
In lieu of that person, you'll take a white lady with blonde hair. I mean, brown hair.
Right, you'll take a skinny, funny lady. So then the second day's worth of rumors was her going on James Corden show and basically denying it. Sort of denying it. I mean, she said that she hasn't talked to anybody from Marvel, but she didn't really deny it. I mean, it's one of those soft denials that if we find out that she really has the role, she can kind of back away from saying that she's outright lied.
Right.
But that's not really the point. I don't care. She gets the role, fine. I'd much rather her glow counterpart, Betty Gilpin, get the role, but hey, that's me.
I mean, honestly, my go-to, my favorite selection so far was Stephanie Beatriz, Rosa from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I thought she was perfect. I mean, and the other thing is, all this talk about diversity in Marvel, I mean, you have She-Hulk who, it's not like people are tied down to one thing where you'll get neo-Nazi nerds going.
That's right. You could put Michael K. Williams as kids. That's a diversity.
You could put somebody other than a white lady in the role and be just fine with it.
Yeah,
I
would be happy with Tiffany Haddish as She-Hulk.
Oh, I don't think I can take that.
I could take that. I like Tiffany Haddish, but not that much, right?
Not that much, no.
So I guess my question is about this. What would you think of Alison Brie as She-Hulk? Like, would you like that or would you not like that? Like, me personally, like I said, I'd prefer Betty Gilpin, but I'm a fan of Alison Brie. I just don't, when I think about her, I don't imagine her as Jen Walters. So,
No. But then again, I didn't think of Mark Ruffalo as the Hulk either, but, I mean, she just seems to, her persona has always been too timid for that role, I think. I mean, even when she's not hulking out, she's still a high-powered lawyer who's fighting for what's right. And Alison Brie, maybe she just hasn't got the chance to, but whether you're looking at Horse Girl or Community or even Glow, I mean, she's always been a little bit too timid for a role like that, I think. And I just don't see her, really breaking that mold that she's created for herself too much.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Ben Affleck kind of pissed me off this week.
Cut in front of you at the Starbucks again?
Yes, did. Ben Affleck, he's been doing interviews for some way back, which I'm really looking forward to. But I'm really looking forward to that movie because it looks like he's invested in it in a way that he is not in D. Reese's film right now. In which he's awful. The last thing he wanted. He's bad in it. Which, by the way, did you see those set photos of him and Matt Damon and Adam Driver in The Last Duel?
Uh-uh.
Did you see those set photos? They're on the site. I post them. And I never post set photos. That's my thing. I've made it a self-editorial mandate to not post set photos. I posted those because they're fucking hilarious. They look ridiculous because they're like, it's like set during the 14th century. So it's like, they're like knights, like medieval knights. They look.
Yeah.
Anyway. So Ben Affleck got on my nerves this week because he was interviewed. We interviewed him. I think it was maybe Cinema Blank or one of those sites that does the thing I hate where they're interviewing you about a movie, they ask about other movies instead. And so they're interviewing you about The Way Back. But they start asking them Justice League questions, which annoys me. If we have another discussion about other editorial mandates, is that our interviewers don't do that. Just save it for afternoon. Don't do it during interview. I can't stand it.
Disrespectful at the very least.
It's disrespectful, man. If I was the head of a studio and I was paying to send our star out to talk about our movie and they spent half the interview answering questions about Batman, I would be pissed. I'd be like, nope.
Side note, not to interrupt you real quick, I just pulled up the images and oh my God. the only person that, so you guys need to head to punchdrunkcritics.com and look for The Last Duel set photos if you haven't seen them already. The only person that looks somewhat right is Adam Driver, who all kind of looks like he's getting ready for a Metallica music video. But Ben Affleck, the blonde bowl cut and the goatee, I don't know what's going on there.
Yeah, and it's directed by Ridley Scott. That movie looks like it. I mean, those are set photos, so we shouldn't judge them. Set photos are not an indication of how the movie is going to look. However,
right.
I mean, however, Ridley Scott, not the most consistent director in the world. And I wrote it in the post, like, I get Exodus Gods and Kings vibes from this thing. Like,
right.
I'm just like, this could be really bad. Anyway, so during the interview, he gets asked about Justice League. And they ask him about the freaking Snyder Cut. And I'm like, I'm over the Snyder Cut stuff. But
it's never going to happen.
Ben Affleck stirred it back up, man. He said it should be made available. I do think Zack's cut should be available. He says, I do think that movie, you know, having two directors is a very weird thing. For Justice League, the director had a family tragedy. So you have a kind of cow's body with a horse's head a little bit with two directors a lot of times, for better or for worse. Well, it was definitely for worse. But still, he stirred the whole thing back up again, and now I'm seeing all the tweets again, like, of people wanting the Snyder Cut. Why won't they let it die? Why won't they let it die? I know Zack Snyder won't let it die. In fact, he's inviting people to come to enter a contest where they can get invited to his shoot of the Snyder Cut, which doesn't exist, or at least it does exist, but it's unmade. And he ain't got the rights to it. Even if he wanted to remake it or finish it, he couldn't do it if he wanted to. It's Warner Brothers stuff, not his. So the whole thing is bogus.
I mean, let's be honest.
if this thing was anywhere near
release ready, it would already be out. I mean, you can't even imagine the number of unfinished VFX shots. If this movie was anywhere close to being, viewer ready, it would be out. Because why would they not make the money? And it's not, and they're not going to spend the money to make it, because whenever you have stuff like this, it's never as good as, you know, if the Snyder had released his cut, people would have been trashing it all day long. And, you know, it's become very popular to just, you know, get on board with something that you wouldn't be on board with otherwise.
I don't know why, but Lee Whannell was asked about the Snyder cut. And basically his response was, Snyder cut, like all of Richter's cuts, sucks.
Yeah.
I like the honesty.
And he's
mostly right. Like, I've seen some Richter's cuts that are better, but they're rare. There's a reason why these get cut. It's because the stuff that's left in, that would be left in, either drags the movie to a crawl, or it sends the movie off in directions it doesn't need to go, or don't go anywhere. There's no time to flesh them out properly, or they just make the movie drag, and they make the movie too long. There's a million reasons why stuff gets left out, and it's usually
right.
for the better.
And
there, I guarantee you, the Snyder Cut of Justice League is terrible. I guarantee you it's terrible. And you can tell it's terrible because he won't stop talking about it, and he won't stop introducing new stuff that was going to be in the Snyder Cut. It's been two years of him introducing new stuff that was going to be in the Snyder Cut. What was this going to be, an 8-hour movie? I mean,
yeah.
I mean, this doesn't make any sense, and people aren't thinking about it. It's like, how many new things were you expecting him to put in this? I mean, come on, man.
One of the things that bugs me the most about it is he has released stuff that kind of confirms his cut wouldn't have been that much different. Some of the most egregious issues of that movie would have been still there. For instance, one of the things that bothered me the most later on was the fact that the end of Batman vs. Superman, it's alluded to that Superman's going to rise from the grave. You have that thing hovering over his casket. And then in the end, they just go dig him up and basically Frankenstein him back to life. Well, it's not like Snyder was going a different direction with that. I mean, he's released things that show that, oh, no, there were more people there digging him up. Okay, you're still digging him up. And there's other stuff like that where it's like, you did the same stupid stuff, but you just did it in a slightly different way. It's still stupid, you know?
And we would have got more Cyborg. We would have got more of the Flash. We would have got more of certain things. man, I don't.
Cyborg, I'm okay with, because that, I think that's the biggest casualty of that movie. Is, and I forget the actor's name that played him now, but that he played that role so well. And yeah, and that character, which is usually not very compelling, was compelling to me in that movie. And I wanted to see more of Cyborg, but there's no chance of that happening.
No. The closest thing we're going to get to see of more Cyborg was that quick appearance by Ezra Miller in this Arrowverse crossover this year.
Which was awesome, yeah.
Where he mentioned Victor. He's like, oh, yeah, Victor. I was like, oh, yeah, that's about the reference to Cyborg they were going to get. That's not in a cartoon or something.
Right.
But my thing about the Snyder Cut is, why don't you just take the script from the Snyder Cut? Just take the script from it. You don't have to reshoot this whole thing. Take the script and turn it into an animated movie for Warner Brothers Animation. Just take the script.
Yeah.
Do it that way. That's what I would do. That way you can cash in on it. Zack Snyder can get his version of the movie out there in animated form. Warner Brothers probably saves some money on it. People would definitely buy it. Why not just do it that way? If it's so close to being done, or if it's or whatever, just take the script and do it that way. Put it out as a movie. Warner Brothers Animation. Those things sell like hotcakes, man. Just put it out like that. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, and if you don't want to put the money into making an animated movie, turn the goddamn script into a book. People will buy anything. You can make money off that easily.
Exactly. It's dumb, man. This whole thing's stupid. But if they're not going to do anything with it, I just want to die. Just go away. I don't want to hear any more about it.
Speaking of dying, I know we're getting close to the end time here, and I know you wanted to talk about No Time to Die.
Yeah, talk about a misleading title.
There's going to be plenty of time to die.
This is the most misleading title I've seen in a very long time. No Time to Die, which is the 25th James Bond movie. It's reportedly going to clock in at 163 minutes. So 2 hours and 43 minutes. Which... I don't need any movie to last that long. That's not the Godfather.
No, that's not especially long for a Bond. Most Bond movies clock in around 2.5 hours, two and a half hours, right?
I have the whole thing on here. Hold on a second. See if I can find it. I have some movies. I had to list it somewhere. Either the franchise. Okay, so Spectre was 148 minutes, which is also too long, and it was especially long because that movie was bad, and it felt like double that time. So I mean, I thought I had Skyfall here too, but Skyfall was less than 148 minutes, because Spectre was the previous record up to that. So we're talking 15 minutes greater than Spectre. And look, Avengers Endgame was 181 minutes. I get it. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was about 3 hours. I get it. I just don't think Bond needs that. I don't care if it's Daniel Craig's swan song or not. They don't. Nothing
needs to
be that. Not for a Bond movie. Not for a Bond movie that's going to be as action-packed as I want it to be. It does not mean the last couple.
Yeah, and you can tell that's what's going to happen. I mean, what they're doing is they're having their cake and eating it, too. They want it to be action-packed, but also with all the intrigue and spy stuff, and that's fine. But I even though I'm supporting it 2 seconds ago, I know that almost 3 hours is too long. I don't think a movie like this should probably clock in about 2 hours, 2 hours and 15 minutes. And I know... I do this all the time.
How about
an
hour and 45 minutes?
I think you're rushing through it at that point. I don't know why, but I think an hour and 45 minutes is good for a throwaway action movie, like a Hobbs and Shaw and like maybe a comedy. But, you know, when you actually have to have a deep story, and the problem with this is they wasted a whole movie with Spectre and didn't do enough with it. So now they're trying to use this one, it seems, to tie up everything that's happened in Daniel Craig's run thus far. So you know that's where the extra time's coming from. And what scares me about that is usually when they take that extra time, they still don't use it right, and they end up just slopping a bunch of pieces of the a story together in the last second.
So basically, make that bathroom run as late to the start of the movie as possible. Maybe get the small Diet Coke, and not the giant sized one. Wear one of those astronaut diapers, something, whatever you need to do to get through it. 148 minutes doesn't help.
But hey, there's a good side to that. It does star Anna de Armas, so that's more time with her.
It not only stars Anna de Armas, but this thing is chock full of, you know, for guys like us, this thing is chock full of eye candy. It's Anna de Armas, it's Lea Seydoux, it's Naomi Harris. I mean,
yeah,
this thing has got, we're gonna have plenty to look at. I mean, that's not going to be a problem for no time to die.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's the one positive to it. And, you know, I'm so glad Jeffrey Wright's coming back as Felix Leiter. I've always loved Jeffrey Wright, all the way back to Shaft, where he played Peoples, you know, back in 1990, the first Shaft with Samuel Jackson. And he's the kind of guy that he seems to pop up every couple of years. He pops up in three or four huge roles. He'll be Jim Gordon in Robert Pattinson's Batman. He'll be returning as Felix Leiter in this. I love that guy.
Got the third season of Westworld coming up again, too, in a few months.
Yep.
So, Jeffrey Wright's fantastic. Even in The Goldfinch, he was actually pretty good. That movie's so crap. He's consistently one of the best things, even in bad movies. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah, he's one of those types.
He was good in The Hunger Games movies, too. I mean, shows are very weird, man. The guy's just always solid. All right, that's pretty much all I got for this week, man.
Good because we're running out of time.
We're running out of time. What comes out next week that we need to talk about? We've got Onward, which is a big next week. Let's
see.
Onward, I've already sort of talked about that a bit.
I should probably know this before we start. Onward, The Way Back is next week.
The Way Back. I think.
Spencer Confidential.
That's on Netflix. And I believe Jake is going to be doing our review of that. I was telling him about
that.
Yeah, that's the movie with Mark Wahlberg and Rich the Duke.
Right. I don't know why that was. Another one's coming out. I don't know if it's going to be wide, but Escape from Pretoria, which I think, you know, looks pretty interesting, actually. Daniel Radcliffe.
I don't remember if somebody else is reviewing that or if that's something I signed up for and now I got to do it. I need to check that out. I can't keep track. That's why I started a calendar. Keep track of the assignment.
Calendars are good.
Anyway, this has been Cinema Royale. I am Travis Hobson. That is John Nolan. We are the Punch Drunk Critics. Check us out at punchdrunkcritics.com for news and reviews. And we will see you on Cinema Royale next week. See you later, my friend.
See ya.
Later.